Today, on this episode of the PureDirect Special Spotlight.
Especially in bladder cancer, there's been a lot of exciting data that's been coming through of how we can use this as something to test for and also to target for our patients that have this expression on their cancer cells.
Today, Drs. Mantia and Berg join the podcast to discuss HER2 in genitourinary cancers, clinical relevance, and real-world testing considerations in this PureDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative's supporters.
Hello, I'm Charlene Mantia. I'm a medical oncologist specializing in genitourinary cancers here at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts, and an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School.
And I'm Stephanie Berg. I'm also a medical oncologist. I work with Charlene at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. I'm also an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
So thank you for joining us. It's been a couple of months since ESMO 2025, and we've now had some time to look over all of the new data that came out. And I'm especially excited about some of the targeted therapies for HER2-positive urothelial carcinoma. Stephanie, do you want to chat about some of the data?
Absolutely, Charlene. To start us off, could you take us through some background on HER2 as a biomarker in genitourinary cancers?
Yes. Do you want to tell us sort of what is HER2?
Well, HER2 is something that has really come up in urinary cancers, and not just in our cancers that we treat every day at Dana-Farber, but also in cancer in general. So HER2 is a growth factor, epidermal growth factor receptor, and it's a good target that we can explore and test for a lot of our subtypes. And especially in bladder cancer, there's been a lot of exciting data that's been coming through of how we can use this as something to test for and also to target for our patients that have this expression on their cancer cells. And one thing that I wanted to mention was when we test for HER2, these are pretty common alterations. Not all cancers can express HER2, but we've been figuring out in urothelial cancers that it can be upwards of about 20% of patients can have at least 2+ or 3+. But if you include all the even 1+, it can even be upwards of 40%. And there is something that I wanted to say about micropapillary variant. It's really important because when we have a lot of different subtypes in urothelial cancer, that is the one that I would always recommend if you see that on your pathology report is to request HER2 testing. Because I know a lot of the later lines that we look for HER2 is perhaps not really in the early stages of bladder cancer, like non-muscle invasive or muscle invasive bladder cancer, but usually in the later lines like metastatic urothelial cancer. So I would, you know, I've been doing that myself in my own practice to really just get this simple testing. And it's something that has really changed a lot of how we can counsel our patients and doing extra testing and how we can also test for the mutations of HER2. HER2 is the protein, but ERBB2 is the actual mutation that we can see on next generation sequencing. And it's important that we can find these in our patients and get tested hopefully as early as possible. I don't know about you, Charlene. When do you normally test for HER2? Is it something you do if you see a non-muscle invasive patient, or is it something you do muscle invasive, or like me, kind of starting off at the end stage and then, you know, kind of going backwards and depending on our practice?
Yeah, exactly. So I think one of the challenges is HER2 testing is not standardized, and so we don't get it, you know, on all patients automatically, and so we have to think about it. You have to remember to do it. And so for my patients, I send it anytime somebody has either locally advanced or metastatic cancer. So anytime I'm starting first-line systemic treatment for a patient with advanced disease, then I ask for the HER2 staining. So I think something that we should talk about is what is the best way to identify HER2-positive patients with urothelial carcinoma. And this is one of the tests that we can't rely on just genomic sequencing.
Oh, sure.
And so the standard way to identify HER2-positive patients is just through IHC. You know, it's a very practical, cost-effective test. One of the challenges is that we don't have guidelines for urothelial carcinoma yet, like we do with breast or gastric cancer. And so we rely on sort of their guidelines, but we've adopted mostly the gastric cancer HER2 staining. And so, you know, we'll do IHC and look at 0, 1+, 2+, or 3+ patients. I only reserve FISH for really those equivocal HER2 2+ patients where you don't want to miss somebody that has the gene amplified that may be able to be a candidate for treatment. But there's very high concordance with HER2 3+ with the FISH. And so you don't need to do it for those patients.
What is your expected turnaround time that we would say for everybody out there if you're getting a HER2 test? I mean, you said it's pretty quick. Is it a couple days, a week?
Yeah, I think if you have the tissue right on site, you know, any CLIA certified lab should be able to do the HER2 IHC. So it should just be a few days. I think the challenge is when you need to get a new biopsy in patients or the tissue is really old or it's located somewhere else and you have to track that down and test it.
Do you test mostly if it's a metastatic biopsy or like from the TURBT, the, you know, transurethral bladder resection tissue, or do you do multiple testing throughout the course of a patient's urothelial, you know, cancer treatment?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think we're still sort of figuring out the best way to do this. So obviously there's, you know, tumor heterogeneity in different tumors throughout the patient's course. And so there was one small study that showed that about just over half of patients lost their HER2 expression from the primary to the metastatic site. And so whenever possible, I try to biopsy a metastatic site. I think there's also a question of over time, is the HER2 expression changing? So after patients are treated with HER2 treatments, you know, are they losing that HER2 expression? There's some studies in breast cancer that show that some patients lose it, but actually most don't. And so it actually may be a problem with the payload as opposed to losing that HER2 expression over time. But I think this is definitely an area that we need to continue to investigate.
I completely agree, especially with something as easy as immunohistochemistry that, you know, at our center, I know we can just ask our pathologist to do relatively quickly in a quick turnaround time versus NGS testing, sending to a company or your own institution, which can take weeks to come back. But as we know in urothelial cancer, we want both. We want all the information, especially about, you know, some of the other mutations that we can target certain drugs for, mm-hmm. like FGFR3 or, you know, even like PD-L1 and other mutations, enroll them on studies. But I know HER2 is becoming really important because it's easy to do. We have a target treatment available for it and something that we can see is pretty common in our population. And so that's been really exciting. And I know that there's been a lot of talk recently from ESMO 2025, there's a lot of important studies we're going to be going over regarding this specific cohort and type of patient.
So, Stephanie, what were you excited about from ESMO? What were some of the trials?
So one of the ones that I think we should talk about is the DISTINCT-1 trial. It's actually a pretty small study. It was about 20 patients. It was a phase 2 single-arm study, and it looked at our newer drug, you know, therapy that we've been talking about a lot in urothelial cancer called disitamab vedotin. So it used disitamab vedotin plus tislelizumab in actual high-risk upper tract urothelial cancer. So these are patients that were either N-positive, and they also had indications for preservation. So instead of getting the typical radical nephrourectomy, they could have, you know, if they had a solitary kidney or reduced GFR, the investigators were really trying to go for a nephron-sparing approach because of these features, and looking at systemic therapy with a biomarker expression of HER2, how they can spare them, you know, this radical surgery and hopefully save their kidney and, you know, have their preserved function. So the trial, it was not randomized. So all patients received 4 cycles of disitamab vedotin followed by tislelizumab, and then they got repeat imaging at 12 weeks. The one thing that I noted about the study was that there was actually a broad range of how patients were enrolled. So they were all tested for HER2. And like we were discussing before, you know, urothelial cancers can go from 0, 1+, 2+, and 3+, but there are actually patients that were enrolled with all the pluses. There was some zeros, there were some 1+, but a majority were 2+ and 3+. And again, they use the same gastric scoring system on IHC, like how you discussed. So all the patients were local advanced. I mean, in the sense that they had at least muscle invasive C clinical T2 disease, and then even some had even T3 disease. So these were really high risk patients. Thankfully, a majority actually completed all 4 cycles of this induction therapy. And then if they responded at time of imaging, they actually went to like kidney sparing surgery or ablations. But if they did not, they actually went to standard radical nephroureterectomy, and that happened in about 5 patients. The primary endpoint they were looking at was kidney intact event-free survival at 1 year was about 70%. And we really did see this among those higher responders of HER2. So it wasn't not seen in the ones and the zeros, but it was really those twos and threes that we saw this better response. And there was about a 70% objective response rate and a 75% clinical complete response rate. So patients were able to have preserved renal function, and they could avoid or even delay surgery. So it was really important because this was a safety profile that for these patients, we don't have a lot of great options or standard of care, especially, as you know, giving them adjuvant chemotherapy is something that we do. But if we can preserve their kidneys, it'd be really important to see how we can bring this forward, you know, for other patients. And like we said before, just testing earlier to give them an option if it becomes approved in the United States.
Please join us for the next part of our discussion on ESMO 2025.
And that's today's special spotlight. Thank you for joining us for the episode of PureDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at PureDirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@PureDirect.com. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing, Medical News Roundup, and just ask, what's my flash briefing? Thanks today to our guest, Drs. Mantia and Berg. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.